And we are live. Welcome to another episode of Roasting Marshmallows. My name is Rolf Suet, and I am your host. So today we are having a guest, a person of diverse interests and broad portfolios. He's a true technical aficionado, and he's calling in from Stockholm, Sweden. But originally he comes from Macedonia. He studied IT and since then has been active in various domains as a developer, lecturer at universities, speaker at conferences, and he ran the Java user group in Macedonia for many years, active with the local software groups as the Hack Club K-I-K-A? Kika? I'm not sure how to pronounce that. Kika? Yeah.
It's close
okay, enough. Yeah. Yeah, I had something here about writing some books, but I think that got removed there. But you wrote HTML5 Data and Services Cookbook, right?
Yeah, it feels like ages ago, like 10 years ago. Yeah, exactly.
And so for the last few years, he has been working as an engineering director at Klarna, where he helped build the Klarna Checkout, Klarna Payment, the merchant card services, and various other Klarna products that are being used daily by millions of people. He's active in developing the engineering culture by being involved in the open source program, events organized by Klarna, and the marketing activities that Klarna does from an engineering standpoint. Currently active as the director of Trust Center, working on scaling at the real-time detection security operations center, live operations, and customer aftercare as part of the CTO office. And he's also a member of the crisis management team, which we'll get into a bit more later on. But first, let me just welcome to you Mite Mitreski. How are you doing, Mite?
Nice to be here. Like it's a pleasure to join this group. I've known one of your employees for quite some time. He was my one of my favorite managers I've had in my career. So I was honored to get like an invitation from him.
Well, that would be Panche.
So that's my first question, right? Why is he your favorite manager?
I don't have favorites, but like he's one of the favorites. He's one of the favorites. I really like working with him. He's like very easygoing, very very good on communication. Takes care of the people and focuses on the business at the same time. So it's he's been one of our the best ones I've
all
worked.
Right.
I'm pretty sure Pons is now going to be sorry he wasn't here.
Yeah, exactly. So like it's best to give praise on the side, right?
That's the question, right? Would you praise him if he were here, right? Because that would be maybe a bit awkward, or which is
Exactly. I kind of was expecting he's here, like to kind of see that awkwardness, but like we're not gonna get that today.
Yeah. We'll record it for you.
So, of course, you guys heard already Arno and Sylvester in the studio as well. So I won't introduce you guys very very much now, but good to see you guys as well here. And Mita, to start off with, because I know Klarna from a couple of years back, because me and Sylvester actually as well. We used to work, we had an assignment at Afterpay, which is, I think, a direct competitor of Klarna. And I think this was like 6 or 7 years ago. So how comfortable are you talking to us?
So I'm comfortable talking with you guys for sure. Like, so when you say Afterpay, there are actually two Afterpays. I don't know which one you're talking about. Are you talking about the Australian Afterpay or the German?
I think the German one then, probably.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so there are two Afterpays. Yeah.
But it's been years, right? So there is no connection there anymore. But I did learn a thing or two about what it is that paying afterwards basically means. And so maybe you could quickly explain to the listener what it is that Klarna offers.
I will try to kind of phrase it in few.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a commercial, right?
Various, no. This is like my personal view of what it is. I wouldn't say this is what our brand and marketing team says it is. So the way I see it is like we enable shopping to be smooth across different channels in different ways. So depending on which location you are based in, like we have quite different portfolio of products. What we are mostly known in like a worldwide setup is the pay in four. Like pay later in four. So you buy now and then you are able to pay afterwards. So rather than like taking the risk up front on what you're buying, you are able to pay that afterwards without any extra added fees. So this is kind of like the basic offering. Obviously, there is like variety of other stuff we have. We are a bank in Europe as well. We have lots of other standards, more traditional banking services in Sweden and Germany, where we have savings accounts and things like that. We also have what is now nowadays known as Super App, where there is like lots of your financial portfolio. You can get like a nice personal finance overview to see like where you're spending. You can get like different hints on like how your like spending behavior is to kind of be more sustainable. Okay. You can also like get activities like, I don't know, your CO2 footprint of your orders that you have. So there's a bunch of different aspects of that, but like kind of we are the gateway to the e-commerce world. And of course, in different markets, we are maybe widely differently known to different extent. So this is how I would phrase it. This is, again, not the official branding.
That's fine. But because I was wondering, right, like the pay now, I mean, the buy now, pay later model, I could see that like maybe like 20, 25 years ago where buying stuff on the internet was like new and like you didn't really maybe trust the website on the other side. But and of course, I can only speak for my personal experience. But yeah, if I go to like most web shops, like I fully trust them that they will deliver the goods that I pay upfront for. Is it still a trust thing with the consumer, you think?
I think to a large extent, yes, it is. I would say like a lot of this, like there is like, if you go to a store, physical store, right, you go and buy things, you get them with you, like the moment you pay, right? But like when you do that with an online store, you have to wait for X days, 14 days, 30 days, 40 days. Sometimes it never arrives. Sometimes you get like damaged goods. And at all this time, like your money are held somewhere else, right? Like you're not, they're not accessible to you for your to use in general, right? So overall, like I think like a lot of that is based on that. We as part of a standard offering, we have this like buyer's protection where we kind of ensure that like you're not gonna get charged. Like so, essentially, we can pause the payments. You can offer a dispute, and like we help negotiate that with the merchant to make sure that you get like a fair treatment. So it varies, right? Like depending on like if you're buying on a regular retailer in Netherlands, right? Like that you have been constantly buying from. Then I would say like probably you feel already comfortable with buying from there. But maybe you're buying something new for your lovely guitars in the back there that is like very exotic thing addition. That maybe it's like very special in this specialty store in a country that you haven't really ordered anything from. Like how would you add that extra security? Yeah. And this is kind of where we come in from one extent, I would say.
Okay.
Did you guys ever use Klarna or Afterpay, Arno or Sylvester?
No, I don't. I just pay up front, but I do know my wife uses it. I'm not sure if she uses Klarna or Afterpay.
No, but like the model at least.
And I think one of the use cases is that you don't pay for everything. Let's say you buy something with clothing or whatever, you have to send stuff back. Then you just pay for the stuff you actually use.
Yep.
Keep, That's so you don't have to check the account if the money actually flows back, yes or no, from that company itself.
And obviously, like, I mean, slicing up the payments also allows you to actually be more flexible in like your own other budgeting. If you're buying a bigger couch or like, I don't know, a PlayStation or something like that, that might kind of hit your day-to-day economy in some way, right? Like allowing this to kind of be sliced over a period of time might be more beneficial for you.
Obviously, there's a big market for it, right? You're processing millions and millions of transactions. I'm trying to steer the conversation a bit to this direction. So you're the managing of engineering or the director of engineering. So how did you set up this department? How do you deal with this load and this market?
So I'm one of the several others, like the engineering directors in the company. We have an organization of 1,800 engineers, I think it was roughly like the last time I checked the numbers. And
just engineers or people?
Engineers, I'm talking 1,800. Okay. And maybe we are around 7,000-ish employees with various different competences. So overall, like there's a quite a different like setup and how things have evolved over time, I would say. When we were starting up, like when I joined the company was maybe, this was like about 6 years ago, was about 300 engineers and maybe 700 something employees. And we were only live in handful of markets, I would say at the time. So overall, at that point of time, things were a bit more traditional. There was a engineering department, a product department, a marketing department, and like obviously people collaborated on projects together and so on. But I feel like a lot of the decisioning required a lot of like top-down approach where things had to kind of circle to the top and then like come back again. Like you could not really prioritize things. We had like a concept of like big room planning at the time, which now in retrospect sounds very silly, but like at the time we would gather the entire organization of engineering, product, marketing, and they would be in a big room, like, which was like a more or less like a big hotel or whatever, or like a area where we could kind of align the priorities for the company.
And that would
so like a PI planning of SAFe.
Yeah, and I think that like that made sense probably at the time, but I think it became like super inefficient. Yeah. You know, like you can't really like priorities shift. Like by the time like you start working on item number two. Item number two is like probably irrelevant now. Like it's probably should be item number 20.
For what term did you guys were planning at that point then? For like for a year or?
No, we were doing like a quarterly plannings. But to be honest, like the industry shifts so much and our focus shifts so much. Like while at the time I could say like we are doing these 10 things, I can't say what are the 10 things we're doing today. Like there is 100, 200 things that individual teams are doing. Around like 2016-17 we kind of decided to go to we can't really scale like this. A lot of this is top down. Like we can't really we can't get innovation like this. We are turning into a big slow moving company. We don't want to do that, right? So we twisted like the organization around, if you will. We tried to have each team be a startup, so each team is treated like a small company of sorts. So they have their own CEO. We call it internally accountable lead. And each person has their competence lead, which is their manager. So that manager might be the same person as the CEO, while in most cases that's rare. So if every single team is given a problem area rather than like working on a project, then they have like a end-to-end responsibility of like a problem space, right? And they're treated in startup in many different ways. So how we do their funding. So myself as like senior leader in the organization, I act more as an incubator with a support team that can actually kind of give investments and also do provide support, like whether that being like legal support, marketing, analytics, and things like that. If the teams don't obviously have that within the capabilities of their own company. And the teams do what we call review sessions, where they actually kind of pitch for resources, right? So they can say like, okay, we want to expand to market X, or like we believe that we need more resources for Y. Like they highlight their own priorities. So rather than like shifting the priority to come centrally, each team has their own roadmap, own goals, own priorities.
And how did this transition actually came to be? Is it something that the C-level suite decided, like, okay, we're going to do the whole organizational change? Or is it something that came from below? Or how did it go?
I would say it was like a year and a half project. And like it's still ever evolving. There is actually a dedicated team called the Klarna Operating Model team that is constantly like tweaking this and making sure that it is able to kind of scale. But like about year's time, different leaders from different parts of the company were gathered in various workshops and constantly kind of worked their way, like, how do we organize ourselves? And we found that, like, having things separate, like, didn't allow anyone to kind of do things end-to-end. So my team could not, like, really deliver end-to-end without, like, Rolf's team or, like, Arno's team. So in reality, we've said, okay, like, we're going to try to model things so that, like, majority of the work, 80%, can happen within the team. Obviously, this is not always possible to do with every single team, but that's the idea, that like Mita's team can drive their own agenda. They can build things independently. Now, us launching a different market, that still will come from a team like Mita's team, but that maybe becomes like a bigger decision where it involves like 40, 50 teams, and then we kind of collaborate together. But for the most part, I would say majority of the metrics that the teams have are on a team level, and then they drive to optimize their metrics or push the targets on those particular metrics.
Is there a lot of, like, because if you say like, okay, we treat all teams as a startup and they need to pitch ideas and all this kind of stuff, is there a lot of competition between the teams?
I think when we were starting up, I would say like, yes, because it was still kind of fresh. We had a little bit of that. It was I want to work in this area and this area. I think nowadays, I would say like, yeah, sometimes there is a competition of like which business area happens here. I wouldn't say that there is like too much of a conflicting bit that like Rolf team is also like competing for the same consumer right. base as Mites team. I think we've tried to tweak the organization in a way that that happens a lot less. And I think this is where kind of like folks like my role or like maybe folks that are domain leads for the individual domains come in to kind of make sure that they have this more, I wouldn't say like fully bird's eye view, but like zoomed out version to actually say like, hey, Rolf and Arno, your teams are actually like having competing metrics. Like one is optimizing for X, but like you're optimizing for Y, and they are kind of like notifying right. each other. So us joining those review sessions helps kind of align that.
And how do you handle that? And what is the, what is the end result? Is one team dismantled, or you change the metrics, or you merge the teams?
That depends. I think it's like it's a very consultant question answer to say like depends, but it really does depend. I think we have cases where definitely like we have dissolved teams because that we have tested an idea and it didn't work out. In my previous role, not as in Trust Center. That happened for two teams that we had. Like we had an idea, we tried it out. Like we didn't got the results we expected. We kind of decided to we're gonna stop this. One of the teams pivoted to something completely different. But others kind of like we said, okay, we're gonna stop investing in this. Like let's move on. So there is like a little bit of that. I would say when there is conflicting priorities, then we kind of discuss a little bit on a more domain level. So these teams are kind of grouped onto a domain level, and then all of these domains report to a CXO, and the CXOs are not split on competences. So, for example, our chief product officer is in charge of our consumer product offering. Our chief technical officer is in charge of our platforms and like merchant offering. Then our if you have a chief expansion officer is in charge of expansion, obviously. And then we have, for example, the chief marketing officer, which is like more consumer growth and brand. Related activities, so like the domains that fall under that space.
So could you describe, go ahead.
Could you describe more of how a team actually looks like? Because I heard you say, okay, well, if they don't have marketing, we can offer them that. So how big is a team and what does it consist of generally?
So, I mean, we are not super strict on the rules, but our guidance is that the team is up to 8 persons. The accountable lead is the CEO of the team is someone that is closest to the problem space. So that might be an engineer, a product person, a marketing person, analytics, finance, like all the different competences we have in the company. And the team has all the competences that they need to handle their own work. So they are generally cross-functional. So a typical, I would say, product team, let's say, that is product-led, has a product manager, has a product analyst, has a designer, has like a few engineers, and maybe they have a marketing person. That I would say like it's more typical for like the ones that are structured like that. But then it varies from team to team. If I handpick some of my teams, I have a solution engineer driving one of the teams, and he has two engineers and an analyst in his group. Then I have another team that has two lawyers, communications person, and a kind of project manager, like let's say management consultant like profile that is part of that team. So it varies from team to team. What is the problem that they're solving? And if you imagine, like if it was a small company, like a 5-person company, what would they need? Now, sometimes you try to fill in the gaps through these incubators, like maybe there is the work is not sizable enough to have a dedicated lawyer on the team, right? Like we have a bird's eye view on that, or the support team needs to kind of do a lot of coordination to make sure that Rolf and Arno's team don't conflict a lot. So then like we have like extended support group. But for the most part, we try to keep it.
And so you mentioned that, Klarna has like a banking license because I can imagine you guys, manage a lot of funds. And you also mentioned that teams should be able to do like end-to-end, just like from inception of an idea or conception, not sure which one is the best term, but until like deployment into production. But at least like the rules here in the Netherlands are like if you have a banking license, like there are a lot of regulations and guidelines that deployments to production need to adhere to that at the companies that I have been in were never really possible to be done by a single team. Like it always needed like people from other teams to sign off the change or whatever. Do you guys have something in place for that as well?
Yeah, so I mean, we are heavily regulated. Like I said, like we are a bank. I don't might not look like a typical banker, but I'm banker in all the.
What's your bonus like? Exactly.
So, but like I would say, like definitely, like we try to handle this with like making sure that the tooling allows this. So a lot of our tooling is based to actually support these bits. Obviously, like depending on the type of goods, there was definitely going to be need of some kind of sign off. It's not like that people can just go completely wild and like do something that is outside of what we are allowed to do. But I would say like we try to give that freedom as much as possible through the tooling. To give you a more concrete example, if I talk in more technical terms, if me and you are engineers in a specific team, we need to have as bank something called enforceable verifiable change control. So like it's mouthful, but essentially it means we need to have traceability that Mitter did this change and it was asked by Sylvester. Like, and we need to be able to show that how the change reached production. And we need to be able to show that like there was no tampering in between. So we have built our tooling to actually fully support this. So there is no way for Mitter to deploy anything to production without having this four-eye view and like a traceability of who did that. And we have this kind of logging around that and like making sure that that gets recorded and there is a paper trail for the full change. I'm explaining this is a very simple process.
Yep.
There is like a lot more complex processes depending on the market, region you are in, which legislation we are, because we are regulated by different financial institutions in the different regions we are in. Europe, it's like you're mostly regulated by your local authorities as well as the European Banking Association, but again, you're working in different regions. Like in Netherlands, you have the Netherlands Data Protection Agency, and it same goes for the other other countries.
But and the teams, they don't feel that as like frustrating or stifling to their like to their flow, because I can imagine like you have to have, you know, I'm just going to assume, you know, Jira tickets for everything and like another system where you have to, you know, put in like a request for someone else to handle and all this kind of stuff.
It does have an overhead, but I wouldn't say it's frustrating. I would say like we've made the tooling to the extent that it's like very easy to do this thing. And we are actively working on making that even easier. So like we've tried to kind of simplify as much as possible. So rather than like, not to compare us with a traditional bank in that sense, but like a traditional bank would probably have lots of like these processes that like look good on paper, but they don't actually function in the real life. While in reality, I would say like a lot of the stuff we have is like definitely functioning and is very traceable and it's made to be easy for the end customers. Obviously, I'm overselling us in this sense, but I really believe this. Like I believe that we the tooling we provide centrally is actually essential to our ability to kind of grow, right?
Okay. At least the recruitment department would like you on this answer.
Exactly.
So can I circle back a bit? Because you mentioned that every team has their own metrics, but you also mentioned you need to report to, I don't know, chief product owner, for example. Is that what I'm not sure if you mentioned that.
Yeah.
How does it work? Are the teams allowed to create their own metrics?
Yes. So so each of the teams is treated as a small company. So they have a review session that happens at least once a month. So in this review session, they're senior leaders. So it's usually their domain lead or their accountable group lead or like is definitely present there. The key stakeholders are also present. So like the service that they're providing, if it's not for external customers, even if it's for external customers, there will be some stakeholders from the company that will be present there. So
those are not. Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah. Those are not part of the team.
The stakeholders.
Yeah, people from within, other people from the company you mentioned.
Yeah, so like this is the reviews. The reviews, no, they're not. Like think of it like think of it if it was a small company. This would be like the board is visiting that small company and they're looking into like, is the team performing well? Like, should we invest more? Like, are the stakeholders still aligned on their actual roadmap? So this is how we kind of try to handle that. And then each of these domains also like presents that to the chief product officer, let's say. But the chief product officer joins those team reviews as well. So like they're actively joining different teams. Obviously they can't join every team constantly.
No.
But they have a goal that they actually visit the teams at least once a year. And if we are focusing more as a company with these 10 teams a little bit more now, there is like we are now establishing them, they need more attention, then obviously that attention from the CXO will come to those particular teams.
And if you have those meetings with, I don't know, chief product owner, is he actually able to change direction of those teams, or is it not possible?
Yeah, definitely. Like the general idea is that these meetings are the fast decisioning, right? Like we shouldn't have like lot of like upwards like layers of decisioning happening. We should be able to do everything within those review sessions. So most of the decisions happen on those review sessions. I would say majority of the cases. The only case where things would not happen on the review session is if you haven't really gathered the right stakeholders. That's the only reason why things would not be able to be decided. And that's how we kind of have driven this not be a big company feeling, even though growing at the same time.
But if you are a true startup, you would say that those decisions live in the team itself, I would say, and not necessarily outside of it?
Yes.
Or am I wrong?
No, you have a point. But I mean, at the end, like you still have the investors that like will need to buy into your decision, right? Like maybe the market nowadays is not as investor deciding right now, but I would say like you're still accountable to something, right? At the end, even us as a company, right? Like we have a board of directors that we need to say the direction and they need to say at the end, yes, on the budget, right?
But on the other hand, you could also state that it's not truly a startup, because if you are a startup, you would also be accountable for the budget and everything else, and your customers, but and the flow of money.
They're definitely accountable for the budget. Like they get access to the budget. They have an overview of the budget. They can ask for more budget. They can have traceability of like how much they are spending. The controls are like most of the admin things we've tried to a little bit abstract away on like more group of teams level. Some of these like business control and things like that. But again, still, all of that is like visible to the teams.
I find this very interesting, right? This is actually the first time I heard a big company doing this, so it triggers lots of questions. But let's take a product of Klarna, like the Klarna checkout, right? So there's actually a team somewhere, let's say for the Netherlands maybe, there's a Klarna checkout team. And that team decides, okay, this is what we're going to build the next period. This is what we're focusing on. Yep. Okay. And then every month you have kind of like a talk with, chief product owner and other stakeholders, like legal and, I don't know.
I mean, I wouldn't say always with the chief product owner. Like, I would say priorities, their stakeholders. So here it would be the go-to-market teams and business development teams that they would need to be invited there. I think the chief product officer would be more for, like, aligning the long-term vision. And if we are doing short-term things that maybe are not aligned with that vision, but I would say, like, majority of that it would be, like, the go-to-market teams here, the ones that work mostly with them, partners, merchants, that they kind of work on growing our partner base. So they would be the ones like driving, this is what the market demands. And then the accountable lead for that team actually then makes the decision of this.
Like, because when you flip around like the decision making, like in the team, it enables maybe for a lot more experimentation, for example, that otherwise may not have happened. Do you also see this change for, you know, more experiments and then maybe like saying like, okay, this worked or this don't work, let's kill this idea? Is there really a culture like that in the teams?
I would say definitely. And it's even more pronounced to like the ones that have really end customer experience. Like they have like some UX. It's very easily visible there. Like lot of the activities people do are like A/B tests and like rolling out functionalities like that. But I mean, this happens across the company. Even like, if I pick my teams now, like the ones that I'm working with, we don't work with now with end customers in that sense. We did like user testing. We did our own version of A/B testing. So like all of that happened for internal processes, you know, and like we are able to do that for the most part. Right?
And in the, you know, if there's a lot of successful experiments and like a lot of value added or, you know, a lot of changes added, like is there any, you know, incentive or reward structure in place for the teams?
So I wouldn't say that we try to tie that directly one to one. Like on that end, right? Like, so just to give an example, like you might be like in a team that has done tremendous amount of work and lots of effort, but at the end, like the idea that we were trying out didn't actually pan out. Does that mean that like you shouldn't at all get rewarded, right? But at the same time, like obviously, like the more value you bring, and the more you're in the heat, yep. sort of say, it's easier to show the value that you're bringing to the company. So I wouldn't say there is like a direct link. Like this is you do X, you get Y. But I would say for the most part, if your team is successful, it's very likely that your personal development and it would be also fairly yep. successful.
Okay.
So does that mean that you do individual bonuses, not on the whole team, but on an individual?
We don't have like that type of like a bonus structure per se. Like okay. we don't give out like bonuses per se. Like there is like obviously a rewards.
But you were a bank.
Here and there, like ad hoc. We're a bank, right? Like we should have like a bonus on that as well, right? No. Like we definitely don't have like we don't have that type of setup. We have kind of actively worked because I think. A lot of that, like if you set out that bonus structure, a lot of that will be based on yep. some metrics, and then those metrics can be manipulated yep. Without like having the underlying yep. value. And yep. that, I mean, we see this happening. Just to highlight, a regular company doing stock buybacks is like the classic examples of like the CXO team of that company not being aligned with the company yep. values, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And when would you say that you guys, because of course, you said like first we did like the whole top-down decision making, didn't really scale much, so we flipped it around. Like was there a single point where you maybe, I don't know if you were in the company at that time or not, but where you said like, okay, you know, this really works? Like was there like a success or something where you could really say like, okay, this approach is working for us?
I mean, I can say it from like my standpoint. I wouldn't say it from our... CXO standpoint, so it's hard to say, but I think for me the big revelation was where we were no longer debating like should we go in market A or market B. Sometimes we've had the debate like should we go into let's say build functionality for Austria or improve something in our core backbone, like which is like completely unrelated like yeah. functionalities yeah. in a sense. And we would have to debate those things here back in the day. The moment we kind of stopped doing this sort of debates, I would say like was one part of like revelation that I said like things are working definitely. Mm-hmm. I would say the other aspect was this concept that when we introduced these newsletters.
Okay.
So each of these startups have a monthly like showcase of like this is what we have been like building and celebration of like what they have actually mm-hmm. accomplished. And at the moment, I started seeing like all of these activities happening in the individual teams, and this was kind of piloted with our consumer app, which we were building up okay. at the time. I think I kind of was completely bought into this idea. Like, while maybe I had previously, like, well, it's a transition period, mm-hmm. right? Obviously, everyone is like fearing change, right? Like, everyone like natural instinct is like change is bad, right? But I think like when I saw that like momentum happening, I was 100% bought into this. Like this was the right call for us.
Did you also experience any downsides of this transformation?
I mean, like it sounds obvious to some extent, but like it's harder to do central decisioning, right? if you want to do like a central push on like a specific policy or something like that, it takes yep. significantly more effort, right? Like it requires yep. a lot more communication, a lot more alignment. So like all of that, it takes a little bit more effort. I think we've tried to kind of apply a concept for that allows us to do these bigger changes in a...
Yeah.
Yes.
I think we are.
I think your browser dropped off a bit. Yep. I think you disappeared a little bit for us.
Just continue.
Yeah. No worries. Overall, like we've set up this concept of leap teams, we call them. So
okay.
Sometimes when we try to do like a central push of a change, like we see that like maybe things are moving too slowly because there is like these three startups need to constantly collaborate with each other for some reason, even yep. though like that shouldn't be the case for the most part. For those cases, we create a leap team. So the leap team, the idea is that there is a specific goal for that team that is should be short in time frame. So I would say up to 6 months maybe, but like in practice, it's usually like we're talking weeks here. So we kind of pull out individuals from the individual teams move them to the lead team to kind of work on a dedicated goal. We maybe add like additional help with like hiring extra folks and like bringing like a lot more focus to that. And through that leap, we actually kind of jump forward in time to kind of push the kind of central direction a bit faster than what we would have normally happened if it was left to the teams. Because then the teams would not have prioritized that central change, right? And that was, that was the...
I do have a bit of a hard time with this because on one side you say we try to see every team as a startup, but on the other hand you say, okay, man, we have a central decision. Sorry, guys, your startup is dead.
Yeah, no, this is not... That's the thing, like, this doesn't stop the startup. It just removes some of the resources from that startup.
All right, so sorry, we had some technical issues, so we're back again. Mita, could you continue on where we left off, and then we'll see the damage that was done?
Yeah, exactly. No, we were discussing about how we are able to push down like central decisions.
Right.
Like, what are the downsides of our like distributed setup? And the idea of like having central changes becomes harder, right? Mm-hmm. Like since it's no longer top down, and individual teams' roadmaps will it's harder to push items top down to the individual teams' roadmaps, right?
So, it's kind of like the goal. That's Arno's point he tried to make.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And I think that was like an obvious downside. But we kind of introduced a concept of leap teams to combat that. So we remove some of the resources from individual teams, and we add like additional like power to that like leap team, which is a short-lived team that kind of tries to push those X teams into a specific direction. And that's maybe a couple of weeks time or like sometimes even a week time. We don't have like many long living teams like that. We usually have like up to 6 months for the most part for like a bigger direction. As an example, we have a team that required like a technical migration project that was ongoing for a year, and we were doing it constantly on the site, and it was constantly getting deprioritized due to like one of the 17 teams that were involved would always have something else more important to do. So rather than like trying to put it like that, we kind of created a leap team. They focused on that, and it was done much faster than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense, actually. If you have 17 teams, there's always going to be one with a different agenda. Yeah.
Exactly.
And
okay.
I want to go to a different topic, which kind of relates to the newsletter that you were talking about, because to me that sounds like a lot of transparency from the teams towards the company. But we've also noticed that Klarna has a lot of transparency, you know, about at least things that are going wrong towards the consumers, because you guys have some blogs written about certain outages and stuff like that. Did you guys choose to do that because of the internal transparency? Like, okay, you know, we're doing these newsletters to ourselves. Let's also, you know, blog about the things that go wrong to our consumers.
I would say it's a combination of reasons why we are doing that. But I would say my personal view on like why I believe in it is our partners like have entrusted or both our partners and our end customers have entrusted either their like financial aspects or their payments to us or mm-hmm. Their e-commerce business to us, right?
Yeah.
So like if we are not transparent, like why would they trust us when we are actually creating an issue, right? So like if we are hiding it from them, like we kind of lose their trust at the end.
Yeah.
So I believe like us showcasing really like what has gone wrong is really like important for us to kind of showcase like, okay, this is what we actually all of the things we did, and this is how we are actually planning to kind of address all of these issues. Because hiding behind that, like just saying like, oh, it's okay now and so on, it's easy answer.
Yeah.
And I think many companies choose to just say things like it's a human error. Like, well, everything is a human error in reality, right? Like again, everything boils down to being a human error, mm-hmm. and there is always going to be a human factor in it. It's just like usually it's a combination of multiple issues, and we do have an internal process of this 5 whys asking like why is the X happening?
Yeah.
Like then like why did that? Like is there an underlying issue? Is it the team understaffed? Is there like something like else? Like maybe 4 people were sick during that week. But maybe something like something completely unrelated. Most of the issues in reality are non-technical in nature if you dig deep enough.
Yeah. And do you then have like a debate first, like how much detail you can reveal in these kinds of blogs? And do you have like, I don't know, like lawyers or copywriters like actually proofreading the stuff? Because
marketing maybe.
Yeah, because I can imagine like, maybe not lawsuits or anything, but you can definitely have some, you know, because you're already negatively affected, of course, by an outage, but then also writing about it and the things that did go wrong. I can imagine it doubling down.
So it's definitely challenging, I would say. Yeah. Myself being included in those processes, I think it can be quite a challenge on the side to kind of how to clearly explain to people without like leading them to the wrong conclusion.
Yeah.
I've noticed this, like even if I ignore the public messages, like my role grow in the company, like when we had like 100 something people in our organization, like. It's hard to kind of give a consistent message. You always get like misunderstood by 5%, 10%, 20% of the people. And when you're doing this public message with like millions of people, like it's, you're definitely going to have like a reaction. So we do spend quite a lot of time to make sure that the message is what we really wanted to say. And that there is like a very little room for misinterpretation. I can't say that we have nailed that, but like it does require quite a lot of effort from both the teams that were involved in the actual issue, getting help from our communications person to actually like translate that, as well as like obviously the lawyers have to have a look and review that as well. But I would say primarily we are focusing on the getting the communication and the message right. To leave very little room for misinterpretation.
And do you have because I can imagine it brings a lot of positive things, but like is there a way for the company to, you know, measure it or at least like get a feel like, hey, this is actually benefiting us to be open and transparent about this?
It's hard to say like that we are directly benefiting from any of that, to be honest. Like,
no, but like, do you get feedback like for a customer say like, hey, I really appreciate you guys doing this kind of stuff?
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Most definitely. I think most of our partners really believe in that, that it's good that they get more information from us.
Yeah.
But I would say like it's not a clear cut for any company to do this. And many choose to like not do this, to be honest, because it's easier to avoid that, right? Everyone wants to just put it behind and like ignore the
move
problem,
forward.
Move forward, like it's the easier route to pick. And I think us trying to be more transparent to our customers is like being like customer focused company at the end is like important to us.
We know you're part of the crisis management team, I think it was called CMT.
yeah.
So how does this go about, right? So something pops up,
yeah, you get a phone call in the middle of the night.
So what happens?
So here we're getting into like more regulatory territory. I can explain a little bit. So a crisis management team is something that is actually a regulatory function for most of the banks that exist. It's a regular function that like to make sure that business operation continues. So for things that threaten the company in a significant level, and those type of events can happen like twice a year, three times a year. It's not like a normal occurrence. So like something, there might be years that nothing like that happens. So like maybe our entire underlying infrastructure had a problem, or maybe something else has happened about that. So in this group, there is representatives from different parts of the company. I'm only representing some of these kind of engineering operations aspects. There is a different chair on that one, and it is a like very formal regulatory aspect. So there is a formal log kept on all of that, and that is showcased to the authorities afterwards. So it has dual function of actually mitigating the crisis, but at the same time making sure that everything is kept in order. And there is representatives from both of our business development teams as well as our communication teams, legal, like security, etc. So like overall, like it's a very cross-functional virtual team like that gets called in a crisis state. Like the teams themselves, on the other hand, like have many mini crises on like a regular basis where they get regular standard on calls that most of like I would say tech companies have.
Yeah, of course. And when a crisis like this occurs, what I've seen at least in some companies is that like, you know, crisis averted, everything is back to normal. But then like top down management chooses to put in like an extra measure of checks or control, like, hey, check with me first before you do a deployment of this, or check with us first before you upgrade a machine to that.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, of course, of this episode, you explained to us that, you know, you inversed the control back to the teams. So I can imagine it's sometimes tempting as a crisis management team to put in, you know, top level down controls back down to mitigate these kinds of risks. How do you go about that kind of stuff?
So,
or do you do that?
No, I think that can only happen during the duration of the issue, right? Like that's kind of where our realm of like ability happens. So,
right.
Like the crisis management chair, quote unquote, becomes the CEO of the company for the duration of the issue, for making the decisions there, right? But that's not something that that continues afterwards. Mm. Like the accountability still lies with the individual teams. We have. I mean, we are a bank again. There is like regulatory function.
Yep.
There is risk control. There
yep.
is there is compliance. We have another layer internally called engineering assurance that helps us like on the automation aspects of this, making sure that everything is traceable and compliant to that. And so, I would say the accountability kind of flows back into the individual teams. We do have processes around this, around like having retrospectives for each of the incidents, regardless if it's like a crisis level incident, right?
Yeah.
That's a rarity, I would say. Like some of the issues happen, like majority of the issues happen on a specific team level or maybe group of teams and impact some customers in a negative way or maybe even like in an unexpected positive way. So like it depends on like what has happened, right?
Yeah. Okay. Pretty good. Pretty nice.
I have one last question about Teams. It just popped up.
Yep.
Do you force any kind of like fixed framework for Teams, or is it all up to them? Figure it out, whatever you want to do.
For like engineering, you mean? Or
Yeah. Well, for a team, right? It's a mini
yep.
startup. Do you have kind of like a framework for them? Or
you mean like if they should do Scrum or like technology-wise?
Scrum, Kanban, or Klarna model? I don't know.
Yeah, I can explain a little bit like twofold. So like if we talk about like generally like ways of working, we have a couple of things that we enforce and that kind of evolved over time.
Mm-hmm.
So we say like teams should have stand-up. Teams should have like a planning and a retrocession with some frequency. We don't really say exactly, like we're not super strict on like how they actually do that. And then at the same time, we say that teams should have a newsletter with some frequency as well. And teams should have a team review session. That's it. Like if they're using Scrum, Kanban, like or something completely different, or so on, that's not on like the process regulated on that. On the other hand, if we're talking about like tooling and so on, to circle back on the how do we keep being a bank and so on, we have certain like we have a service rulebook that actually puts all of these rules and says like you have to do X, you have to do Y. And then there is you should do X and you should do Y. And there is mechanisms around how that actually is applied and enforced. We do believe in like giving the freedom and having the ability to actually propose new things. But then for the most part, a lot of the high level aspects are added there. So for example, you cannot deploy on your own in production. That's actually enforced through our tooling and so on. You cannot like have a unreviewed change reaching production. Things like that are enforced. It's not enforced to like what exactly kind of library you're using for X, Y, Z, or like or I don't know how the pixels are placed or so on. That's more to like guidelines and standards there.
Okay.
And for example, you mentioned tooling and do you also have like code reviews, for example? Because if a team chooses to do, for example, mob programming or ensemble programming where, you know, 6 or 7 people are actually looking at the code, do they then still have to push that code in a branch and then do a, you know, pull request and then ask the guys that already, or the girls, sorry, that the people that seen the code already to, you know, double review it again just to satisfy the process?
Yes. Yes.
Awesome.
We won't ask you for your opinion.
Yes. But like, if they already seen it, right? Like, it should be an easy task for them to do that, right?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Easy or pointless?
Yeah,
it's.
But
yeah.
How much of an effort it is to kind of do that extra?
Yeah, yeah.
Then, like, if they have done that, right?
Yeah. No, but it's an interesting case, right? Where you just you go through the motions to make, I guess, the reviewer, and not the reviewers, but like the inspection happy, But I guess you also
the process.
That's what I mean. Like you have to, but you have to play by the rules, right? When you
no, but obviously, like, and I at the end, like, you need to know that, like, Ralph saw this. It was not just Mita writing this.
Yeah.
And like, if that's not recorded anywhere, how would you know that actually that happened? Right? Like,
well, it's just a policy, right? It could also be you are not allowed to commit anything to production on your own.
Yep.
That could also be a policy, because if you do, let's say, pair programming as a minimum, then you actually don't have this issue anymore.
Yeah, but then how do you know that you someone actually sat in the chair right next to the to the developer?
Exactly.
So then you have to like put cameras on people.
Do you think that forcing a code review, people would actually look at it? I could also blindly approve. There's no difference.
Yeah, definitely. But like then we do have like extra controls on that, right? Like you might have an incident. We kind of go circle back and like we actually kind of say like, okay.
Well, there's no control, right?
So
the control is an illusion in this part.
Yeah, no. I mean,
you facilitate the process. Like, that's what I'm saying. Sure. And I blindly approved a lot of code reviews, just like this, you know, bam, done.
So I mean, like, let's pick an example. Like, so let's say there is like a manual process that you're constantly like, Mitha is submitting this pull request constantly, and Arno has seen like 10 pull requests of the exact same thing, right? He got bored at this point of time, right? He doesn't want to see this. He's just gonna click approve. Like for those type of processes, we actually like, and this is not for mostly, it's not for code. Like we kind of try to have this like for other like manual actions triggered.
Okay.
We ask actually, Mita is inputting in one place, Arno is inputting the same thing in another place, and they then something on the background checks what the input that is the same, and then it, only then it goes out.
Okay.
So it does create double work in those cases. I think that's some of our like customer support routines and things like that are based around that. But that's the way we kind of try to ensure to kind of remove the boringness of it. But like you can't get away from like some of these bits. And like then you need to have extra measures of controls and like checkups and like random sampling and so on.
Yeah. And are these all these checks and controls that you have, are they all mandated by the banking license, or do you also, because I don't know if Klarna is maybe like on some stock exchange somewhere, but do you also have like many other rules and regulations that you need to abide by?
I mean, there is many different regulations. When I say regulated, like one part is the banking aspect, there is data protection rules, there is like there is a bunch of different compliance aspects that we have to abide to, and like certifications and so on. So overall, like I wouldn't say there is like one thing that mandates us to do that. And I think many of these things are actually like, even if there was no mandate from like a banking authority, they make sense, right? Like the 4i policy like makes sense to me. Like there is like no reason why like non-bank should not have that, right? Like why would you not have that, right? If you have the abilities to do that.
The 4i's principle, having it, I think we all agree with it, right? You shouldn't be the one on your own writing code for a financial institution. And well, I get
for,
that part.
For any institution, like even like
we agree, we should do a mob. You should do a pair, right?
Yeah. But
it's kind of like how you solve it. And I get Arno's point, but I also get your point, right? We've all been there and having to deal with this. But so being a bit mean, maybe asking about how you deal with it.
Yeah, but it's a very interesting topic, I think, and. I think every company solves it differently, and because it's all just it's rules, right? It's just someone writing something down, and the way that you handle it, like you guys, you know, fix it in the tooling, which hopefully makes life bearable for the engineers, which I think is a great thing. But I can also imagine a lot of companies just do it like a lot less tooling based, but more just like, hey, you have to play by these rules, and making life very, very difficult.
Yeah, but if you don't, I believe if you don't have the default to make it easy for people, they will actively try to find a way to
fight the system.
Like approved code reviews.
Exactly. Yeah. So if it's not easy to do that, like people will try to actively find a way to not do that, right? Like regardless of like what type of setup it is.
Yeah,
I actually have a story on this.
Yeah, let's hear it.
So
man.
I'll finish with that. There was a company, I'm not saying the names, and they had the same process. They forced people to actually do code reviews and approve. And so this person actually automated that approval process. So he just created a script or whatever to actually go to the page, go to the code review, and automatically approve it. And then that's it.
But then who approved it? Like, did he use his own personal account?
Yes, his own use. Yes, he just used his own credentials. He automated this manual process. Yeah. So I think that kind of defeats the whole point of the approval process. And I think he is probably not the only one. So I'm always having a bit of doubts on this whole concept of two or four eyes principles with code reviewers saying it works now.
Well, I think it's also important to let people understand why it's important, maybe.
Yeah.
But there is I mean, I would say like other controls. Like, let's imagine there was like an auto approver Arno, and like he always approves like Mita's pull request, right? Like he at some point Mita will make a mistake, right? Like and when that mistake happens, like someone will say like, hey Arno, Mita, like how did like let's look at how we actually missed this. Like, how can we get better next time around? Like, what would Arno say? Like, he can still lie, obviously, but like we're getting into a lot of like territory. Like, then do you do 6-eye reviews? Like, is that like gonna be what?
And I think the point of the code reviews is also because a lot of code reviews are being used like, hey, you know, this comma is in the wrong place, or I would put an enter here. But I think for a lot of rules and regulations, the point is, of course, a lot more high level than those kind of nitpicky things, right? Okay. So I think that kind of wraps it up for today. Mita, I don't know if you have anything to add, by the way. If you felt like you need to share something with the audience, then of course, feel free to do so.
I mean, I have a big question, like, how do I convince you to try out Klarna a bit more, like that's kind of like my personal, like, always be selling aspect, but like, how do I convince you to give it a try? Like,
I'm Dutch, right? So I always go for the cheapest option. So for a lot of these pay later payment options, you always see like, hey, you know, you need to pay a 250 premium or whatever.
Yeah.
Man, if there's a web shop that does a free option to do pay later, I'm definitely going to give it a shot.
I would say we have quite a lot of Dutch stores that have free pay later. And I would suggest you to download the app, try out like the discounts there. So all right. I think like I'm kind of like echoing like the Dutchness in this sense, right?
All right. Yeah, man, I'm gonna download the app. That's a good suggestion. If you have some discount codes, then I'm a sucker for discounts, so gonna do that for sure. Thanks a lot. So Sylvester, Arno, do you guys gonna try Klarna now?
Yeah, of course, I'm going to download the app as well and check it out. Right? I've now learned how the whole engineering department is structured. I think it's rather impressive. So
yeah.
Let's see if it's up to par, right? And how the quality is.
I have my reservations myself, but I'll tell my wife to use it.
All right.
But at least I've acquired 3 customers, so like it's good.
So there's your bonus, right? That's the bonus structure.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, Mita, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And Sylvester, Arno, thank you guys as well. And of course, I want to thank the listener for tuning in. Sorry about the technical difficulties in the middle there. I hope you guys haven't missed much. And if you have any suggestions, then feel free to send us an email at podcast@4scouts.nl. And of course, you can reach us on Twitter. That's twitter.com/4scouts. Mita, do you have a Twitter if people have any questions?
Yes, Mitreske at Twitter.
All right. We'll include the link in the description. Cool. Well, thanks very much, and see you guys later. Bye bye.
Thank you.